43 degrees by the time you're done with the caffeine. End of this presentation. And, lots of caffeine up here, too. So if it gets about to a meat cooler status, you'll know that we're all paying attention. Nobody drifting off after a nice lunch. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Butler, members of the committee. Thanks for asking us to come down here today and give you some information. And I think we're all assuming this will be a casual discussion more than a presentation, and so we'd be happy to answer any questions you have at any point in time.
So if you have questions, colleagues, as we go along, please just go ahead and make sure that you throw your hand in the air and yelp.
My name is Jerry Hansen. I'm the Director of Assessment and Taxation at Washington County, and I want each of these people to introduce themselves, a little bit of background maybe. We have a mystery guest here, too, by the way. I've been there for about 33 years, about 16 years, I think, as assessor there. So that experience, along with these two gentlemen, and the transition of this property tax system in Oregon over the last Measure 5 and Measure 50 processes. And I think that's going to be a lot about our presentation today, is kind of the transition and how it works now.
Chair Butler and members of the House Committee, my name is Dennis Day, and I'm the Polk County Assessor. And I've been the Polk County elected assessor for about 20 years now. And I've worked with Polk County off and on for 30 years, close to 30 years. So I'm here to kind of assist Jerry in giving you a little background on more of the assessment side of the duties that we perform on a calendar year.
Well, I guess I'm the mystery guest. My name is Tom Linhares. For 17 years, I was the county assessor for Columbia County. Last April, I took a new job as the director of the Multnomah County Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission, which oversees the budgeting and tax levying authority of those taxing districts within Multnomah County. I guess my claim to fame is that I had the fortune or misfortune in 1997 to be the legislative committee chair for the Assessors Association when this body dealt with Measure 47 and then Measure 50. And so along with Jerry's help, I spent pretty much full time between March and July in these halls helping craft Measure 50. So I guess I have to take part of the blame for that. But anyway, so I'm here just in case there's anything that Dennis and Jerry can't answer. Maybe I can answer a little bit better. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, during Measure 50, Tom and I were just known as Tom and Jerry. It was kind of an interesting process. What I'd like to do is start out with, I understand you've had a presentation from staff and more of maybe an aerial view of the state in terms of property taxes and how they work from John Phillips and Mary. And so I think what we'd like to do is get a little closer to the ground today and try to tell you some of the things that we do on a daily basis and how things work from our perspective. And I'll try to use these handouts as a guide as we go through this discussion. In general, this post-Measure 50 system, in my mind, the way I look at it is how does it balance up between the taxpayers, the administrative folks, and the taxing districts? And so I made a couple notes here, and they're probably fairly obvious to everybody, but I think it's helpful to think in terms of how that balance is met. For the taxpayers, I think Measure 50, the biggest thing about it is it's made the tax bill a lot more predictable, and I think people are a lot less worried that they're going to be surprised by what's in their mailbox in October. And there's a couple things that are involved in that, as you know. Under Measure 5, each person's tax bill is tested against rate limits for schools and for general government. So there's a very specific limit for each person's property tax based on real market value, and $5 for schools and $10 for general government. And that's I think, quite a bit different than it used to be, where the limit was on the levy that the school could impose, and the basis for the tax bill would be how that was divided up among the value in the district. And if somebody's value went up more than somebody else's, the burden shifted. And that became a big surprise to some people if we had reappraised a neighborhood or something. And now that doesn't happen. The other thing is Measure 50, the limits, again, are on the tax, individual tax bill itself. So instead of having some kind of a general limit on value, it's a specific limit on each person's value. And each tax bill has a very specific record of how we create their assessed value from year to year. And we'll get into that in a little bit. Of course, the other thing is that's helpful is there are permanent rates. Before Measure 5 and Measure 50, the taxing district's rates were basically determined by the levy divided by the value in the district. So the rates fluctuated from year to year, and it wasn't easy for people to understand how the rates were created. Now it's very, very easy. Which brings up the next issue, which is local option levies. And I think what we're seeing is that more and more governments are relying on local option levies to balance up the budget, their budgets. And it's becoming an interesting process of trying to, for the districts, that is, to try to figure out how to take their local option levy requests to the voters and whether they should go in an election that's going to require a double majority or not. But that makes it more predictable for the taxpayer because they're seeing most of their levies being on the same same ballot in November on an even numbered year. So that's starting to have a more and more of an effect, I think, in terms of people's ability to pass all those levies in on any given November. But the results are a lot fewer appeals. In fact, when Measure 5 was implemented in Washington County, we had 7,000 appeals that year. And now I think this year we have about 350. So it's a dramatic change, in, at least from the taxpayers' perspective, on how threatened they feel by their value each year. For taxing districts, it's kind of a mixed bag, I think. They obviously rely now on new construction and development to provide any kind of an increase along with the 3% adjustment. And that's, in some cases, volatile, and so it's not as predictable as it used to be. It used to be they would, prior to Measure 5, just submit their levy if it was approved by the voters to the assessor, and we'd process that into a rate and extend it to the tax bills. So the district pretty much could predict what their levy was going to be from year to year. Under Measure 50, it's a rate-driven process. They have a permanent rate, so the value creates the revenue for them. And it's definitely more volatile. In Hillsborough, 2 years ago, we had actually almost a negative. Wasn't quite a negative, but I think their taxes went up by about 1%, 1 or 2%. And what happened was the economy for high tech had created a lot of problems, and the appraisals the Department of Revenue did included a lot of obsolescence in the value of plant and equipment. So the result was that Hillsborough got a big surprise. We weren't necessarily predicting it either from the assessor's perspective on how much value was created that year. And instead of their normal 8 or 10% value increase, it was maybe 1 or 2%.
That's the value as the fair market value or the real market value?
That was actually the assessed value.
Oh, the assessed value.
Right.
Only went up 1%.
Right.
But isn't there a limit, Measure 50 limit on the increase that it shouldn't have gone up more than 3%?
Yeah, normally maximum assessed value limit under Measure 50 can go up. Well, actually, normally the assessed value on each account can go up 3%. And a lot of properties are assessed at real market value because their real market value is less than the maximum assessed value. And especially industrial and utility and personal property, because their property depreciates from year to year, machinery, equipment, personal property. And when property depreciates, the real market value becomes the lower when you compare it to maximum assessed value. So if you have a lot of industrial property like Hillsborough does, it tends to go up and down based on real market value as opposed to the Measure 50 limit.
So the with regard to bonds that are that have a value or that are assessed against the property, those are assessed upon the assessed value, not on the real market value as well. So if the bond is going to attach at 10 cents per thousand, that's the thousand of assessed value, not on the real market value.
That's true, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Chair.
So I think the and along with the double majority requirement, I think the districts gave up some of the predictability, and the taxpayers now have more predictability, so that balance has been shifted. And then there's the assessors. I think the impact on us, and probably is well known, but maybe not, and that is the system is a lot more complex, and I think more complex than Tom and I envisioned it when we were working with the committee in 97, because we have to keep a totally new kind of value called maximum assessed value, and it's, I think we'll demonstrate today some of the complexities, and I won't get into that right now. But as a result of that, the good news is that there are a lot fewer appeals. And so we have more time to do things beside defend our values in the Board of Property Tax Appeals. So that's a plus.
Jerry, one thing I'd like to mention to the committee is when Jerry was talking about local option levies for schools under compression, I'm sure this committee may deal with that sometime in this session, is that I put some numbers together for my county this year. We had a school district that went out for a local option, and they failed. And this is the second time they haven't been able to pass a local option. But what happens a lot in local options is because of compression, the school districts, they don't realize how much they're going to get through the loss of compression. And an example I had here is this particular school district wanted to ask for a dollar per thousand rate for a local option. And that would have raised from the total property owners in that district about $858,000. But because of compression, they would have only seen $435,000 of that. And so compression takes a lot of, because under compression, it compresses first the local option. And so,
Dennis, let me just ask a question.
Sure.
That's a school bond for a that must not.
Well, that would have been an operating. That was
okay,
an operating.
That's an operating.
It wasn't
so what
a bond.
Talking, 5-year serial
right.
levy is that what it is?
Yeah. Yes, it was. It
okay.
was a serial levy for operations. It wasn't a bond.
Okay. All right.
Right. And I know I've heard other stories from other districts where they thought they were going to get X amount of dollars. You know, they had triggered in their budget. And then when it came to the time of the assessor and collected the tax dollars, it was far less than what they had anticipated. So these taxing districts got to be very cautious of the compression part when they do go out for a
thank you, Dennis.
Local option.
The chair recognizes Representative Riley.
Could you explain compression?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley.
Is there anything in the packet that helps us go through that by any chance? I think this is a very, very valuable exercise, and I really would like, and I've directed the others that will be presenting here, to bring lots of graphs and charts and number exercises so we can see what compression looks like side by side. So maybe someone from the counties in the back or someone else can start to draft up what a compression looks like, or one of you gentlemen could do that. because we're gonna get into compression. We need to see how it looks and lay it out side by side. That's it. Thank
you. Mr. Chairman, I think we can probably discuss that, but I think the important thing is that I've seen too many taxing districts get caught in that trap where they think they're going to get dollar for dollar.
For serial levy bonds, that's your recognized Representative Hass.
Thank you. There have been proposals in the past, and there will be again this session, to raise the local option amount. Are you saying the compression, it wouldn't matter if we went from 10% to 20%, that scenario that you just described, that wouldn't change that, would it?
I don't. Right here.
Representative Hotz, no, it wouldn't. Measure 5 is in the Constitution, and that's what creates compression. And the way it works is each person's tax bill has a limit on the amount of dollars that they will pay in education taxes, and that limit is based on their real market value times $5. So there's a dollar limit on each tax bill based on their real market value. And so the complexity of it for the taxing districts is we have to actually give them usually it's a huge spreadsheet of every taxpayer's real market value and tax rates in their district. And then they do the what ifs. What if we had a dollar local option levy? How much would we collect? And the way it's calculated is account by account compression. And basically what they find out is the higher that local option levy amount is, if it's a dollar, they get X amount of compression. But if it's $1.50, they get a lot more compression because more and more accounts are impacted.
Now, you represent Multnomah, Washington, Multnomah, and Polk County. You all have properties in serious compression in these counties. Okay, Representative Hass, I'm sorry I interrupted you. Please proceed.
Oh, thank you. I was just wondering then if there was any way to, if we were to change state law again to increase that local option, if there was a way to deal with this dynamic of compression and increasing the local option parameters.
There's that constitutional. Constitutional.
Chair Butler, Representative Haas, I'm not sure what you mean by the maximum local option. Are you talking about the amount of local option that's counted in the state school fund formula?
Local option measures that, 10% or what is it now? It's the local option law, 10%.
5% of schools, 10%.
We're talking about the measure.
The local option that we add on that allows Beaverton to, or Portland or whoever, to raise their property tax.
Paul has the answer.
Is that the state school fund?
Warner, LRO.
It's the amount of dollars that can be raised through a local school option without counting against your state formula revenue. When the bill first passed, it was $500 per student, or 10% of your operating funds. That, with the last session, was raised to 15% and $750 per student. So, of course, the limit on this, the first limit you come to was compression. So, it's the gap between 5 and 50. And then these other limits are after you hit that. So, if you hit that gap first, then you're not going to collect the 750.
Well, the first limit you need is the gag test amongst your constituents that are going to be voting. You've got to be able to convince them that number one, that there is a true need for that serial levy and that additional resource within your school, don't you?
Yeah. Well, but I think what the assessor is saying, Mr. Chair, is that you've got to tell them what the impact is. Because if somebody comes and says, well, gee, how does that affect the average house? It's going to vary depending on
the taxing district.
How close you are to compression.
And that's a function of the taxing district. You may be in with your permanent rates and those other kinds of yes, Representative Boak, was that responsive, Representative Hass?
Yes.
Representative Boak, which is recognized.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify for me, and I think more of a question of Paul, if you'll indulge me, Mr. Chair. I think we saw a chart in one of the other ones that I think there's only two counties in the entire state that aren't in compression now, if I recall correctly, in one of these charts we saw. So no matter what you do, everybody's already compressed. Across the board, I think if that chart was correct.
It's taxing district by taxing district. For instance, in Ontario, we only just have, there's only just a few properties that are in compression. This is a couple of years back. There's only a few properties that are in compression because we have the 1.5% compression. But then in Ontario, there's also a $15 per household tax for the ambulance service district. And so if you've got a very low-cost mobile home, and it's taxed, the land is taxed at X amount, then you throw on $15. Mobile homes, very low-cost mobile homes, were in compression, and other lots adjacent to it or down the street were not in compression. Also, it also is dependent upon the district that you're in. Because adjacent to Ontario, you might have a rural fire district and then a rural road district, mm-hmm. and some of the other kinds of things. And those folks each have their own permanent tax rate that is thrown into that 1.5%, well, 1% total, because education has the upper limit of 0.5%. But you're absolutely right. Every county, I think, without exception, has some compression in it.
That's not static.
It certainly changes with regard to the amount of assessed valuation.
Every year, yeah.
Right. I'm sorry. Have we gotten off into some other territory? And I don't know whether I think I see Michelle Dyster back there working frantically on something. Not sure whether she's drawing house plans or whether she's working on some compression calculations. Excellent. Thank you. Continue to draw, Michelle. Representative Boquist, was that responsive?
It's responsive. I guess the point is, much like Representative Haas, is we're pretty much maxed out. No matter what we do, it impacts somebody. And I'm still slightly confused, but we'll fix this later, I guess. But I know what I saw was that every county was impacted. If you pass the local levy, no matter what, however you start doing it, you're taking money from somebody else and it's going like this.
Well, one example, and I don't know whether it's still is a valid example today, but in some counties there was a discussion of passing a weed tax or something like that, a local weed abatement district or a gopher abatement district. When you go to apply that, the only places that weren't in compression were the rural areas. In other words, if I'm paying $1.50 today on my home in town, and the people out in the country are paying $1.27, and you put a 10-cent weed abatement tax in, only the rural people are going to pay for it. Well, guess what? Most of the weeds are in the rural area, probably. So, you know, you've got some give and take in that process. So I'm anxious, and when I say only the people in rural are going to pay it, what's going to happen is everyone's going to pay something. Wow. If it's countywide. It's just it may mean that your city's going to get less tax, or that your cemetery district will get less tax, or some other special district will get less tax. So we need to, in this process, we need to be kind of respectful of folks that we're dealing with here, because everybody across the board is going to get whammed when you're in a compression situation.
Thank you. Since we're so far off this mark, that I'm going to just keep continuing. But you mentioned the gag reflex, and I just want to indulge me, something that happened in Beaverton that I just still think is remarkable. But they did pass a local option about a year and a half ago, kind of the height of the economic downturn or the bottom point. And the school district said, we have an emergency, we need your help. And they voted to raise their taxes 60%. In the second year of that levy, the school district, through all kinds of financial dynamics, said, you know, we no longer have an emergency. So we're not going to collect this money. And in effect, put the property taxes back in the pocket of taxpayers, which to me felt like, you know, government credibility and restoring that credibility. And I still think it's remarkable, and I still have taxpayers saying, I can't believe, has that ever happened before in government? I don't know if it has, but if we had that same relationship statewide as we have in that little corner of the universe between the school board and the taxpayers there, then I think maybe we could start talking about some of these big things that Oregon needs to do, tax reform.
Representative Hass, I hope that you step forward and took full credit for it. I've
absolutely
never seen an opportunity like that. Representative Riley.
I just wanted to say, Mr. Chair, that I now remember the discussion on compression that we had before, and I understand what it is.
Okay. So. Thank you. Please proceed.
So we could probably talk about compression quite a lot. I, I think the one thing that helps me understand it is there is a capacity in each person's property for collecting a little more under a local option under Measure 5, but it varies from property to property, and you have to remember that a lot of the industrial property is already assessed to real market value, so there's zero compression there. I mean, there's zero capacity there because they're already taxed at real market value, and the rates are already $5 or more usually for schools. So in other words, their real market value and assessed value is the same thing, so there's no capacity for more local option levies for industrial, utility, and personal property. And so what you're doing is you're trying to get the capacity, the remaining capacity in residential taxpayers' properties. I just threw in this article from the Wall Street Journal. This is a way of saying it. Things could be worse. It's talking about kind of the way it used to be in Oregon, really, when people would get big surprises in their mail and revolt about it in terms of their taxes. And I got two things out of this article. One was in Harris County, Texas, they had about 180,000 appeals this year and last year. And so I'm just happy I'm not there. And the other one was that the average property tax or medium valued homes in the U.S. In 2002 was $2,549, and it's $2,778 in 2004, which is really fairly comparable to what I calculated for Washington County's averages, and I'll share that in a second. On the next page here, I wanted to give you just a rough kind of history of the trend of taxes in Washington County with a couple points to make. If you see the bar chart on the third page, you can see that in 1997 was the kind of the base year for Measure 50. And the average rate in the county was $14.82, and it was fairly stable. But in 2001-02, you can see it jumped up to $15.93. And that was the result of $41 million in new levies that were approved by the voters. So we can't say the voters aren't willing to approve new taxes. What happened there was all over the county, including the county public safety levy, PCC, the Tuolumne Valley Fire and Rescue District, Beaverton School District bonds, Hillsborough School bonds, Forest Grove School bonds, Sherwood Police Facilities bonds, North Plains Police, Local Option Levy, Gaston Rural Fire District, and Wilsonville Library, they all got approval for new levies. And so the rate on average in the county went up to $15.93.
And that Gary, exceeds the $15 because it is over the, you're using bond amounts in here as well.
Mr. Chair, yeah, there's two reasons it exceeds $15. One is that the rates are based on assessed value. So the rates we're assessing are on assessed value. The Measure 5 limit is another calculation, but the rates we extend are on assessed value, so they generally can be higher than $15 because assessed values are lower. The other reason is that bonds are not part of the Measure 5 limit, bonded debt.
So the $15 per thousand is based upon real market value?
Right.
Okay. All right.
Right.
Thank you.
And so you can see that what's happening, in that period of time between when Measure 50 was implemented and 2001-02 is we had a lot of taxing entities receiving more levies from their local voters. And that was kind of the way it was for a couple of years. And then you see in 2003-04, it jumped up to $16.59 per thousand. And that was mainly the result of the Beaverton local option levy, the Beaverton School District local option levy, because it was $1.50 per thousand. But then you'll notice this year, the rate on average countywide went down to $16. And that was solely the result of the Beaverton local option levy, because they're about half of the value of the county. So you can see that it really does make a difference. The folks do have a lot of ability to raise their taxes, even in this system. And on the next page, it's just a real average of the average market value, average assessed value, and average tax rate countywide for single-family houses. And I just did this as a way to demonstrate the trend in taxes in recent years. And if you do the calculations, it averages 3% per year in taxes. And you might notice that the and this is for Washington County here, by the way, so I don't know about other counties, but this matches up really well to the average median house tax in the United States. I thought that was kind of interesting. I'm not sure what that means, but I just thought I would throw that in. The next thing I was going to try to do is talk to you all about the complexities of dealing with Measure 50. And just let me know if this gets too tedious. But I wanted to really try to help you understand the complexities of it, because a lot of folks, including I think Tom and I, didn't think Measure 50 was going to be quite this difficult to administer. And so I'd like to share some of this with you today. In general, Measure 50 invented a whole new limit on value. I don't think there's another one in the United States quite like it. And after we rolled the values back to the 95-96 levels and subtracted 10%, we said that you could only add value under certain exceptions, and your committee's heard about the exceptions that allow the assessor to add value to maximum assessed value, which is the Measure 50 limit. It's new construction, and if you change the status of your property from an exempt to a non-exempt, help me, Dennis.
Disqualification,
omitted property, rezoning if you change the use of the property. So there are about five or six real specific exceptions where you can add value to the maximum assessed value of a property. But you can add value for general ongoing maintenance and repair, and I threw this in just to give you the definition of what it is. And it's generally speaking, if you're just repairing your house and replacing the same functional quality of materials that was there to begin with, general maintenance. The next complexity involved in exceptions is that, and this, I think this is a case where the assessors kind of got what they asked for, so I don't necessarily blame this on the legislature at all, is minor construction. In Measure 47, there was the idea that we wouldn't put minor construction, we wouldn't add minor construction as an exception, so we wouldn't increase somebody's assessed value if they had minor construction, but it wasn't defined. So there was a lot of discussion in committee about what that was going to be. Assessors said, well, it should be a $5,000 threshold each year, so if somebody, you know, added a deck for $4,000, we wouldn't add it to their assessed value, and the committee didn't think that was high enough, because when we took ballot Measure 50 out to the public, it was one of the things that was emphasized in the advertising, and so the committee really wanted something more than $5,000. And of course, the assessors kept bringing up, well, somebody could, you know, the committee wanted $10,000 per year to be the threshold for minor construction. Assessor said, well, you know, somebody could build a house over 10 years at $10,000 a year, or they could put several outbuildings on their farm, $9,000 a piece, and they wouldn't have any tax impact. So what happened is we got a test that would be $10,000 in any one year or $25,000 over 5 years. So we now have this thing we have to keep track of on each person's tax account, and that is, anytime they do anything that's less than $10,000 a year, we have to keep track over a five-year running time frame to see if it exceeds $25,000. So that's been quite interesting. And
so if you have 10,000 accounts that you're assessing, you do a sub-account on each one to show that they did $5,000, and I assume that's based upon building permits. So if we've got somebody who says, you know, I put a roof on that portion of the shed, which is now an overhang.
True story. That's right. Okay. And the chart here shows you that in Washington County this last year we had 1,600 properties that had minor construction. In other words, it was under $10,000 that we didn't add to the roll, and that totaled up to about $5 million that didn't go to the roll. And it's broken down by the kinds of things involved there. Some additions to property or some new construction, maybe an outbuilding or maybe somebody's foundation. They were in the process of building a house, but on January 1, their foundation was all they had there, things like that. So minor construction sounded fairly innocuous to us back in 97, but it's turned out to be kind of an accounting system in itself. And as you turn through the handout here, we've got I put the rule from the Department of Revenue in here just to show you the kind of guidelines we have to manage this thing. And the department included six different examples as a way to demonstrate how to deal with this minor construction requirement. And one of the real problems was it going to be a continuing running 5 years, or would it be reset after somebody reached the $25,000 threshold and it was decided that it would be reset? And then there are a variety of other little issues involved that, you know, a good example would be example five, where you've got the first year you've got $5,000 in improvements that doesn't meet the $10,000 threshold. The second year you've got no additional improvements. The third year you've got a $15,000 construction item that's added to the roll, but you can't add the other value that preceded that because it doesn't exceed $25,000. So in the fourth year, the $7,000 item and the $5,000 item that was in the first year add up to $12,000. So you have to keep track of that because you're continuing to keep track of the $25,000 in five-year issue. Enough said about minor construction.
I couldn't agree more.
So the next thing I want to talk about to try to demonstrate a little complexity is the way we deal with exceptions themselves. And I think initially we were thinking just that, you know, it'd just be a way to add new construction, and a couple other issues would come up, but it would be pretty simple. But we found out that the real question is how do you change maximum assessed value if a whole variety of things happen to the property besides just new construction? And the first set of examples here are things that the appraisers do generally. We're talking about major additions, new construction, remodeling, site development, and maybe demolition of a house. But you've got a lot of other issues that come up where you need to do something to the account value because it's either an acreage correction or maybe it might be a disqualification of part of an account, or it might be a special assessment or a rezoning. It might be a situation where you have a fire, an act of God. And so there are a variety of ways that you have to handle those values. And we found out that there isn't a simple calculation. It's got to be handled according to the way the law works. And I'm not even sure I want to get into this with you, but I laid this out to show you in Washington County how we work this out in the computer so that we can code the different kinds of activities with the right calculation method so the computer will handle it. And it shows you the numbers of each of these types that we had last year. So on the next page...
Exceptions, 14,000 exceptions?
Yes. Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that we've realized is how much time it takes to do this work. It's probably at least half of the appraiser's time is spent on new construction and other exceptions. So the next thing, next tedious detail I'd like to take you through here is how we actually figure out the exception value on a, and this is a fairly simple one, fairly typical account. This happens to be a house that was a fairly old house in a neighborhood in Hillsboro. It had 968 square feet and of main area, and it's had a little enclosed porch in the back, 7x12 enclosed porch. And that was before the property owner decided to remodel the house. And if you look on the page that says after exception, you can see what happened. The property owner added a little 6x12 area and rebuilt the porch and created a total of 1,124 square feet of main area, and then added a porch on the front of the house, 156 square feet, and added a wood deck and a garden shed and a concrete driveway. And in the process of doing that, it eliminated the enclosed porch. So what we have to do is we have to figure the difference, of course, between the house before they did this work and the house after they did this work, but we can't include ongoing maintenance or repair in that calculation, and we have to make sure that it exceeds $10,000. So what we do in Washington County is we have this before and after exception process that doesn't include the kind of things that would affect would be general ongoing maintenance and repair. It's only the pieces that would qualify as an exception. So in this case, if you turn to the next page, you can see the net effect of, for this particular one, there was a minus for removal of the porch in the back, and then minus $226.80, and then plus $14,670 for the main area new improvement, and then the other miscellaneous improvements were an additional $5,480. And the net effect of that in terms of real market value was $20,150, which exceeded the $10,000, so we can add that as an exception. And the next page, it just shows how we keep track of each exception. You have to start out with the assessed value, which was $58,490. Then you add 3% for the new year. And then you can add the value, the real market value of the exceptions times the change property ratio, which comes out to $12,880, which is the actual impact on the maximum assessed value. And so that, I think, if I haven't put you to sleep already, I'll turn it over to Dennis. And
Gary, where is the 3% added, the 3% calculation added
on that particular assessment screen.
Right. Mr. Chair, you can see where it says Measure 50 on the left side.
Right.
The previous assessed value was $58,490.
Okay. So that's the previous assessed is 58.
Right.
And so your plus 3% is the $60,000.
Right.
And that's the Measure 50 limitations.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can add the exception value down below, which is the new real market value times the change property ratio.
Okay. $17,470.
Times 0.737.
And the 737 is the?
That's the change property ratio.
And how did, is that part of the, is that a function of the permanent tax rate?
I'm going to let Dennis talk a little bit about that, but the change property ratio is a device that is used in Measure 50 to bring real market value down to the assessed value.
So that's the inverse. Okay.
And the purpose of that is to bring real market value to the level of other taxpayers in their class of property.
Okay. Now this is so this particular property has a total real market value of 127, nearly 128,000. But has an assessed value of $60,240. So are they going to be paying tax on the $60,240? Are they going to be paying tax on the $73,120?
Mr. Chair, it turns out that after you add the exception value, it's $73,120.
Okay. And that exception would be due to either additions or property values of the same property class.
The exception is the new addition, the real market value of the new addition times the change property ratio.
Oh, this is that same property we just looked at.
Yeah.
Okay. Added to it.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. I'm sorry. Thank you. Representative Berger.
So had they done nothing to this house, they would be at the $60,240.
That's correct.
Okay. But because they added to it some qualified and some unqualified in terms, then they ended up with the $73,120.
That's correct, Representative Berger.
Okay.
And can I ask one other
please
question?
Please, follow up, Representative.
Do you determine this work by looking at records of permitting, or do you go out and evaluate every house? How do you make this determination? And
Chairman Butler, Representative Berger, the typical process is that when a homeowner takes out a building permit, the city shares that with the assessor, or it could be the county. And we also get a copy of the plans, and so we get a diagram and figure out what's happening with the property before we even go out to the property. But we do go to the property, and we do try to figure out what was there on January 1st each year, because if they're halfway done with the process on January 1, we can only pick up the value that exists at that point in time. So, number one, we do have to go to the property. And number two, we do have to know what actual new construction existed on January 1st. Because that's the assessment date.
Okay. Let's see. We're going to go back to Dennis.
Mr. Chairman, have we convinced any of you want to work in the assessor's office yet? Jerry and I, on this presentation, we kind of worked through email and on the phone. So right now where I'm at is what's called the assessment tax calendar. That's the portion I'm walking into. Jerry wanted me to talk a bit to the committee about our annual functions that we perform in our office. And I won't try to do a lot of overlapping what Jerry went into, but I also have some examples of some of the complexity that we work with. On that calendar, you'll see some of the key highlights is some of the work we do as assessors is on a calendar year, And the tax collection folks do it on a fiscal year, so they're collecting the taxes on a fiscal year, and we're evaluating the property on a calendar year. So that's where you see some overlap here, where you see January 1st is the assessment date. That's the date that we try to value property. What was there January 1st is what we value the property. March 1st is an important date to this. This is the date where we get all our personal real property returns back from the business and the industries. We have to process those. April 1st is another important date. That's when we get all the applications. They could be farm deferral. They could be forest land. They could be veterans. They could be senior citizens. All the applications that we process usually come in around April 1st. May 1st, we have to provide the Department of Revenue with an annual racial study, which I'll get into a little bit more. July 1st, of course, is the fiscal year for tax purposes. September 25th, that's kind of the critical day that the assessor builds up. All year we work towards turning the assessment roll in January. On September 25th, we do all this work with anticipation of creating values on all properties, so then we can do the tax calculation process and then send out the tax statements. So our critical dates is January 1st and September 25th. Also, we need to get the tax statements out by this October 25th. Your first payments for your taxes is November 15th. And December 31st is the last day you can appeal your property. Like Jerry mentioned, my county, pre-Measure 50, we averaged about 400 appeals a year, and this year I had 12. So we'll probably wrap up our appeal process in one day. And I can tell you that the Board of Property Tax Appeal appreciates that because they're a volunteer board who has to listen to these appeals. So that is one thing that, you know, just to emphasize what Jerry said, one of the savings to some of the counties has been the fact the predictability of what your assessment's going to be every year. Second page is I counted 7 types of values that we could potentially store on a piece of property. This is the byproduct of Measure 5 and Measure 50, the two limitations that we have. Before we had Measure 5, we only had to keep the real market value and the specially assessed value. Well, now we have to keep the MAV, the exception, the minor construction value, the specially assessed value for farm forest, the maximum specially assessed value for farm forest properties, and finally the assessed value. In Polk County, you know, we're not quite as large as Jerry, but our exception value last year was about $172 million. That's probably a couple of industrial counts for Jerry in Washington County, but it represents about a 3.5% of our total assessed value growth came from new construction. Also, Jerry mentioned minor construction. In our county, we, for purposes under $10,000 on an account basis, we have about $8.5 million. That's being stored value on particular accounts. They have not triggered the $25,000 yet over 5 years.
Jerry, is that something that could be demonstrated on this whole process, or it's more information?
I do have a handout
that might be confusing.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a handout that might explain some of that, but if you turn to the next page, I'd like to kind of simplify this in a handout. What you should see is just that's a fairly innocent tax statement. There you can see two values. You see a real market value of this particular property for this year had $332,640, and the assessed value was $116,552. Now that looks real simple on the face, but if you turn to the next page, you'll see the value breakdown of this particular property. This particular property is in a rural area. It has part of its property is under farm deferral, part of it's under designated forest land. It has a residence. And you can see the values that we're storing. We're storing the real market value. We're storing the maximum specially assessed value, the specially assessed value. This particular account had some exception value for this year. So you can just, this is a good illustration of about every type of value we have to store in the system. But the bottom line is, all the taxpayer sees is their real market value is $332,640, and their assessed value is $116,552. But in our systems, we're storing a multitude of values, and under Measure 5 and Measure 50, it says that the property owner is to pay the lesser of all these values that we're storing in the system. The lesser of the real market value and the maximum specially assessed value. The lesser of the specially assessed value and the maximum specially assessed value. And what I mean by those two values, you know, they're farm and forest properties pay at a lesser rate assessed value than their real market value. And this specially assessed value is the current productivity value of the farmland or the forest land. The maximum specially assessed value is the 1995 value of this productivity growing by 3%. And so we have to store all these values in our systems internally to produce the tax statement that says how much you owe us. There's quite a bit of complexity there, and there's quite a bit of numbers that we have to store. And the second page there is just the third page of that document is just an aerial photo of the piece of property. This is again is a byproduct of what we do in the assessor's office. Our cartography sections have to maintain these cadastral maps, or in a lot of cases are called base maps. But just in a nutshell, I wanted to just illustrate that, you know, we can dazzle with all these types of property values that we have to maintain, but I thought if I illustrated to you that particular property, there we're maintaining quite a few values to produce their limitation values under Measure 50 and Measure 5.
What's the designation, Dennis? SAOFD.
That is the productivity of that soil class. That is that's the soil class, how each one of those is, if it's a designated forest land, that would represent the productivity of that soil for growing trees, well, and likewise for farmland.
Let me just ask you, I'm looking at your full assessment account, and it's in the last box down, and you've got, this is where you're coming up to your total taxable value is what it is, and the reason I'm looking at that is that every one of those has to use the low value, mm-hmm. proper or class by class. So when I look at the SAOSD,
right,
it's got an RMV. If I look up above, that has a trended market value of 15,500. So it's got an RMV of 15,500, but a Measure 5 value of 4,000, exception value 10,800. Previous maximum maybe taxable value 4,000. That's it. So it's limited by Measure 5, 4,000.
Right.
What's the phenomenon?
Okay, I can explain that. You're talking about the specially assessed OSD charge, mm-hmm. Where I believe you're talking about the SAOSD.
Yes, sir.
By law, we. When it, this means this property is a farm site, and it's to be taxed at a statutory farm use value, not its market value. And the statutory farm use value is not to exceed $4,000 for specially assessed, but the maximum specially assessed value is the 95 value growing by 3% since 97. And in this particular case, the specially assessed value is less than the maximum specially assessed value, so they pay $4,000.
But that's not growing by 3%?
No.
And the reason
no, that's
not?
Statutory. That's a statutory value that's frozen at $4,000 for farmland that has a farm site on it. There is a statute that limits the assessor to $4,000 on the specially assessed value for those sites. So that becomes the lesser of the values for that particular.
Even with the 3% increasing
right,
faster,
right.
It still goes back to the major
yes.
5-4,000.
I think the as I said on the AV, when I talked about the AV value, I mentioned that the assessed value.
That's what I would have taken it to. I would have assumed that it was going to go to the 4,400 AV, but it's evidently frozen at 4,000.
Right.
And I didn't know that we had property that was frozen, but because it's specially assessed, and that must be the SA, specially assessed farm or forest property, mm-hmm. just must freeze it somehow.
Well, it's in statute. The statute says for a farm site, the specially assessed value cannot exceed $4,000. I mean, that's in stat. That's statutory value.
Mr. Chair, just for maybe a bit more clarification, what that represents is the on-site value for a farm home site?
Oh, this is what we used to have as site improvements for residents,
right.
For the rural residents.
Right. In this case, it's a farm home site in an exclusive farm use zone.
And that locks at 4,000 by statute?
Correct.
Okay. Yes, Representative Conk is recognized.
I have a couple of questions, and if this is way off the path, just say, you know, talk to me afterwards and I'll explain it.
No, I want to know the answer too, Representative Conk.
Well, my question is, you know, as we look at land use reform, and it's a little off revenue pathway, I know it is, but you can pull up a report that basically tells us what acreage and property is designated as farm use zone, forest land zone, and all those things.
That's correct.
Okay. And that's readily available.
Yes.
And then, depending upon what zone they are, it's like this, they have the different caps. Or the $4,000 cap for
yes.
the farm use. But where I'm going is, in my district right now, they're wanting to take 103 acres of designated farmland and turn it into commercial property. And so I'm trying to figure this out. And like, well, how much is that farmland worth? Is it they're going to pay the farmland rate for that farmland, or are they going to pay for the commercial rate if it gets rezoned? I don't know. I'm just trying to figure out.
If it gets
reasonable. Well, Representative Cobb, the special assessment program is based on the use of the land and not so much on the zone. So, the land is used for a particular purpose. It
right.
has a statutory savings
okay.
assigned to it, so it doesn't really go with the zoning. And we have properties that are zoned industrial and commercial. Not many, but they're being farmed. And as long as they're being farmed, they can qualify for the specially assessed of farm use.
Okay.
So zoning is just not doesn't automatically remove the specially assessed value. In most cases, in your example, it should make the real market value more valuable if it goes from farmland to commercial land.
Mm-hmm.
But if they maintain it on the special assessment qualifications, they can still receive the special assessment value.
Okay.
But then, excuse me, if I can just ask there, if they went ahead and subdivided it without redeeding it, and continued to farm it, even though it was subdivided, does it maintain its farm value, its specially assessed value?
Mr. Chair, if it continues qualifying, it could.
As a farm. So they could subdivide it, continue to farm, and then at a later time, is there a penalty for pulling it out?
Well, there's going to come a day of reckoning where they might have to pull it out, and then at that time they'd have to pay the back taxes from taking it out of the furrow or changing the use.
Thank you, Representative Conk. Well, can you follow up?
Yeah, no, I'm fine. It's just I'm trying to, my brain's moving really fast, and I'm just trying to keep
well,
up.
Well, catch up with it. If you need to.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Escobar.
I'm real curious. There used to be a board where people came in and we're talking about assessment here, and Freddie Farmer over here had 30 acres. It was next to a river, and the river changed course, and he only has 25 acres. How does he feel? And Joel, the guy across the river, now has an additional 5 acres.
I get asked that question a lot. You know, people are always questioning why I'm assessing for something they don't have anymore. There are appeal. I mean, property owners can appeal just about anything that concerns them at the local level or the tax courts. In that example, there's been times where people have come in and the river has changed the course or changed their property, where we have gone out and tried to determine how much land they still have is usable, and if there's a great deal of value that's been lost, we'll reflect that in our valuation.
And that
can be just a request of the property owner. It doesn't have to be an appeal process.
Yeah, Representative Berger has something to say about that, though.
On behalf of Mr. Day, Representative Boquist, and myself, Representative, I would like to comment that in Polk County, we don't let our rivers get away with that. And you better get them under control in Southern Oregon, is my suggestion. Hey.
Actually, in 1964, it was a real problem in Medford when we lost about half of Shady Cove. The other thing is, would that pertain also to a house that burned down?
Sure, Representative Esquivel, that would. I mean, if a house is destroyed, we'd be obligated to take that off of the roll. Plus, we'd have to reduce the maximum special assessed value. So,
let me ask another question in that regard, Dennis, and this is probably not quite as onerous as a burn down, but for a person that owns the property, probably every bit as catastrophic, and that is, what happens when you've got a rental property and it's used as a meth lab, which leaves it uninhabitable? Still standing there, lovely $200,000 home previously, used for rental, septic tank, home. What's your position with regard? What are the assessor's positions?
Well, you might get, Mr. Chairman, you might get three different answers here if you got three representatives of the assessor's office. But we do get those, and we get those notifications, and we usually reduce the value immediately. And then at a later date, the jurisdiction will let us know if they've given a clean bill of health, and then we go back out and review it again.
Mr. Chair, yeah, actually, we would reduce the real market value of the property, probably based on a cost to cure the problem, but we wouldn't reduce the maximum assessed value.
Okay.
It would remain the same.
So the RMV would be the upper limit of the tax at that point. So if the RMV was zero, then or sort of $200,000 property, and the home's going to have to come down, and the land's going to have to be remediated, and the cost of that's going to, well, if the cost of the home goes away, and the remediation is $100,000 to remediate the soil, and you've got an $80,000 lot that it's sitting on, then you've got a zero. You can't go below zero, so you start with a goose egg and go up from there, I suppose.
That's a possibility.
Tom?
To show you how bizarre the Measure 50 system can be, and I think it's to our credit the assessors have actually come in since 97 and affected legislation to make it better. But under the original Measure 50 scheme, maximum assessed value never changed. There's no provision for lowering maximum assessed value. We took the 95 real market value, reduced it 10% in 97, and then as long as the real market value is higher, that maximum assessed value could only go up 3% a year until they hit. We've had cases where the house burnt down. So the real market value is now, say it was $300,000, now it's $80,000. But the maximum assessed value was $250,000, which is typical. Real market value $300,000, maximum assessed value $250,000. Taxes are based on the lower of those two, $250,000. The house burns down. The market value is now $80,000. the maximum assessed value is $250,000. Taxes are based on $80,000 because that's the lower of the two. They wait a year, so there's no netting, because Measure 50 said we netted improvements with additions like Dennis showed you or whoever had the example. But if they wait a year, there's no netting. They build a new $220,000 house, and going through the CPR calculations, $220,000 times the CPR gets added on to the $250,000. So now you've got a market. Your market value is back to $300,000. The maximum assessed value is $500,000. I mean, those kinds of bizarre cases did in fact happen. Until we got legislation that says if property is damaged or destroyed, and there's a couple of different statutes and it got sort of convoluted, they can't apply to the county assessor to have the maximum assessed value reduced. Because in the original version of Measure 50, there was absolutely no provision for maximum assessed value to be reduced under any circumstances.
Okay.
So that's...
But that
had some bizarre results.
Cured in part, at least, with the curations of an appeal to the assessor.
Right. So now we can reduce that maximum assessed value. So the market value would be 80, and the maximum assessed value would be 65 or something. So then when they added the house back on, we'd get back to the same ratio we were had before.
Bob, just occurred to me, if there's 36... assessors and assessing agencies outside of the Department of Revenue that assist with some of this. When we have constituents that feel like that they're not getting the water to the end of the road with their particular assessor, what's their right of appeal beyond their local appeals, the Board of Tax Appeals?
Mr. Chair, there's actually a very responsive process. Of course, the first stop is to go talk to your assessor and have a discussion with the appraiser, and normally that will resolve any situation, but sometimes not. And the next step is an appeal with the tax court magistrate. With the Board of Property Tax Appeals. It's a local volunteer board of citizens. A lot of times that resolves the case, but if not, the next stop would be to the magistrate division of the tax court. And from there, you could go to the tax court. Of course, the final stop is the Supreme Court.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? I'm on the change property ratio page right now. And this, as you're aware, that there have been new properties that have been created since 97. I mean, so they need to have new maximum specially assessed values created for them. And the way we do that is that, first of all, we have to figure what the real market value of the property is as of January 1st. And then we run that real market value through what's called a change property ratio. And that basically is a ratio between the assessed and real market value of these certain types of categories of properties you see here. 100 would be residential, 700 is apartments. So each county assessor is required each year to figure out the change property ratio within the boundaries of their jurisdiction. And in Polk County, you can see what our change property ratios are right now. And again, that is based how that is figured. It's a county-wide total real market. If we just talk about residential property for a minute, the county total real market value in comparison to the county assessed value. And right now, our residential properties, our maximum specially assessed value on an average county-wide represents about 80% of its real market value. And so that example you see there is if I pick up a new house this year for $250,000, I will run it through the change property ratio, and their maximum specially assessed value will be the $205,000. That's what they will pay property taxes on. And that is the value that from this point on will grow no more than 3% every year. So we did try to build some uniformity as much as you could in Major 50, is the change property ratio is to bring existing properties back, new properties back down to an existing level to what similar properties are paying taxes on.
Sure, recognize Ricky, right?
Just a question. You have these property classes and these CPRs, and these are countywide CPRs by type. Are all counties countywide by type?
Representative Riley, they are to be. That's what our statutory goal is to use this classification and use them on a countywide basis. Jerry?
Representative Riley, this was one of those things that was debated in the 97 legislature about how to keep some fairness in the Major 50 system, and we happen to have a classification scheme that we use for our ratio studies, which are studying the sales, those sales are divided into these classes of property, and there's actually a lot of breakdown among each of these classes, but the general classes were already there for us. We were very familiar with them in the Department of Revenue. Ensures that all counties employ those classes the same way statewide.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
And since the maximum, this can never go above one, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
What actually happens, Chair Butler, there are properties, as I mentioned before, personal property used for business purposes, utility property, and most industrial property that those groups have a changed property ratio of one in most counties, because those kind of assets depreciate. And when you compare the real market value with the assessed value, typically you'll have the real market value being lower, because that value declines, and so it gives you a ratio of one or higher.
And in this regard, then, and I'm sorry, I don't know the names of all the towns in your county, so I'm going to have to use some of mine. A home in Halfway, and a home in Baker City, and a home in Richland, and a home in Sumter, they're all personal single-family residences. Are all going to have a CPR of the same ratio countywide, even though homes in Sumter may sell more or less frequently than homes in Halfway?
No problem.
Chair Butler, that's correct. And actually, I can recall that Dennis and I had a different concept. And Tom and I were working on this, and we were trying to come up with a concept to kind of, in effect, equalize new property with existing property. And I remember that Dennis thought that wasn't quite fine-tuned enough. And, of course, we had a debate among ourselves and decided that we really didn't have the ability to fine-tune it anymore. We didn't have an existing mechanism, and we were reinventing a whole new system anyway, so it was very, I think, convenient, and it's worked fairly well to use that property class system that we use for the ratio studies. But you're right, it's countywide for every property and the residential group and so forth and so on.
And Representative Bradley is correct, that's based upon construction. That's construction, not sales. All right? There are sales in there, too.
The calculation of the changed property ratio is all of the property in that class, and it's the assessed value of all the property in class 100 divided by the real market value of all the property in class 100, excluding any new exception value, because that would throw the calculation off. So it's just all the existing property in the class, real market value divided into the assessed value. That's how you get that.
Okay. I didn't get the answer I wanted a few minutes ago relative to where my constituents could go with issues and problems. Where can my assessor go in a small county or a small number of properties county? I assume that the department has some folks that they can go to access information. Of course, they are members of the 36 County Association of assessors within the AOC. Is that, I assume, you share information and keep the other 33 assessors up and on top of this?
Chair Butler. The Oregon State Association of County Assessors has two annual conferences, and we spend quite a bit of time together at those meetings. We have a group called the Joint Tax Advisory Group that was really, I think, started in the process of Measure 50 as a way to get issues on the table among all the assessors and the Department of Revenue. And that meets from time to time whenever it's necessary. Department of Revenue does an excellent job, I think, of providing through either rules or classes or guidelines a whole lot of information to provide for uniform assessment of the system.
Jerry, any of our counties that do not have adequate or at least some good software and hardware applications for these kinds of things, you share those back and forth amongst yourselves? To try and minimize or reduce the costs amongst the counties?
Mr. Chair, I think that's really a good question. The way it's evolved in Oregon in terms of computers and software is that I think it's safe to say we have three fairly competitive. First of all, I don't think any county, there might be one or two, but most counties acquire their software from private software companies. And the reason for that is I don't think any one county can do it themselves. It's just not economically viable. The cost is too high. So there are about three competitive companies out there that provide the software. And we usually have maintenance agreements with them to have them change it if there's a change in the law, like a Measure 5 or a Measure 50. At their cost. And so typically what we have is at least three or four counties use common software. And right now, as a matter of fact, there's a situation with one of the companies that is basically going out of business. So those counties, and they happen to be primarily small eastern Oregon counties, have gotten together and done a study to figure out where to go, and they've done that together, where to go to get new computer software. But I think the good news is there's a competitive situation among three good vendors, and it kind of ensures that we don't have to worry about somebody walking off the job and not having a good replacement system.
Colleague, well, you're very close to the hour, and I know that others of you have appointments, and we did not get all the way through your packets here. Paul, will we have an opportunity to come back and ask more questions? And I know Michelle is working on a, and she'll finish that at a later date. But an item for compression there. Paul, can you give us an update as to what our schedule may accommodate these folks? Dennis, Tom, Jerry, we appreciate your coming today. Apologize that we didn't get all the way through your information.
let the colleagues have this available, and we'll kind of work the schedule to let you know what our opportunity is to next get together on this issue. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I think after listening to this today, I think we ought to offer up September 25th as Oregon State Tax Assessor Day.
I put that in the form of a bill, Representative Thompson seconded it, and we'll move forward, and Representative Riley will carry it on the floor. So with that, colleagues, we're going to go.
Chair, I just offered this up, but I have a compressor in my garage.
Is that the picture we have
compression
in Leakenbergen City?
Thank you very much. We'll stand adjourned until tomorrow at 1:30.